All right. Oye, oye, oye. All persons have been before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw an eye. And give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess it is now. The court is pleased to be here at Texas Tech University School of Law to hear the case of Halcom v. Shinseki. Are counsel ready to proceed?
We are.
The counsel representing the appellant, state their names for the record.
Zachary Stoltz, Chisholm, Chisholm, and Kilpatrick, on behalf of the appellant with me to count the table is Landon Overby, also Chisholm, Chisholm, and Kilpatrick.
And for the secretary?
Jim, Secretary, my name is Mark McNabb, and with me at counsel table is Deputy Assistant General Counsel Jill Moriarty.
Very well. Mr. Stoltz, are you principal?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have 30 minutes for argument. Do you wish to reserve any time?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, please.
All right. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Your Honors, the crux of this case involves the broad consent form found at record 426 through 427 in this case. The form says only that Mr. Halcom consented to the attendant risks as described above on this broad form. The disabilities at issue in this case are not described above. Indeed, they are not described anywhere on that form. The Secretary asks this court to take his word for it that these disabilities were, in fact, described to the veteran. The regulations are clear. Mr. Halcom needed to be told of the risk of endophthalmitis, retinal tear, and a vision loss. The record indicates that this condition may have been a rare risk, yet the board has found that it was foreseeable. Still, the Secretary asks this court to believe the information regarding the possibilities of this risk were given to Mr. Halcom because of that broad consent form. The Secretary erroneously argues that the question in this case turns on the appropriateness of documentation. This is not the issue in this case. The question is whether Mr. Halcom was given information from which he could provide his full and informed consent as required by the regulation. Under
Counselor, is there any indication in the record at all that the appellant asserts that he was never told of the complications that could be attended to the surgery?
In the record note, in those specific words, there is nothing that Mr. Halcom says specifically that he was not informed of those risks. However, I would submit that that is not Mr. Halcom's burden in this case. Rather, he asserted negligence on behalf of VA medical personnel. And therefore, the burden per regulation is on the Secretary to prove that this informed consent was given. It's a burden on the Secretary, and in other jurisdictions, a burden usually placed upon the physician. Therefore, in his broad claiming, in his broad claim that he filed, and which this court has construed broadly, historically, and which the board construed broadly, he has made a broad claim for negligence, which would, of course, include whether or not his consent was informed.
Now, exactly on what basis would the Department of Veterans Affairs be responsible for compensation to Mr. Halcom?
Under 1151, under 38 U.S.C. 1151, it states that veterans are entitled, and this court has held that it is similar to a service connection claim, that basically those same criteria apply, and under that, should this have resulted from VA medical personnel and it was the result of negligence, or if it was an event not reasonably foreseeable, as described in the statute, then that is a finding of negligence. And the regulations go on to point out that negligence is also established if there is a lack of informed consent per 3.361 and then ultimately 17.32.
Is there not evidence that There are medical opinions indicating that there was no negligence on the part of the individuals performing the procedure on Mr. Holcomb?
The medical opinions that were obtained by the department do say that there was no negligence. However, that is only part of the question, because the regulations prescribe that one way to establish negligence per se is if the veteran, if there was no informed consent to the procedure.
Now, this was in the VA hospital, so he would also be eligible to file a claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act?
That is correct, Your Honor, within a certain statute of limitations, as I understand it.
And if he were to file a claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which law would apply in terms of making this determination?
I believe this was done in the state of Illinois. Therefore, I would imagine that the Illinois law would apply to this case.
Do we have to apply the Illinois law to determine whether or not the consent requirements were met?
I believe, if I understand your correction, your question, Your Honor, I don't believe that you have to apply that law. I believe, as the Secretary indicated, that the law that applies here, because this is an administrative proceeding, and we are proceeding in this court, and we are proceeding under the administrative remedies in this case prescribed by 1151, I believe that the Secretary's regulations are what controls here.
But the negligence factor that's under 1151 certainly would have to be governed by some negligence law, would it not?
Well, I believe that the statutes do speak a bit to negligence, and I think that the board has tended to apply standard of care questions whenever they ask VA medical opinions. I believe that they ask if the negligence was something that is under the ordinary standard of care.
So is your position then that, at least in terms of the consent form required by VA regulation, that there would be a reason for the doctors to specifically state to the patient every conceivable, foreseeable risk that would be involved in the procedure?
I believe every reasonable foreseeable risk is certainly what is prescribed by the Secretary's regulation, 3.361 and 17.32. I also believe, and after this court's supplemental order, did some research as far as other jurisdictions for whatever that's worth. And it seems to be that, while I wouldn't go so far as to say it is a consensus, it seems to be very broad in other jurisdictions that these risks specifically, the foreseeable ones, need to be described to the patient and need to be documented.
This was a cataract and lens placement, cataract removal and lens placement?
That is correct, Your Honor, on the left eye.
Would a notice that anytime we conduct a procedure on your eye, there's a risk of going blind be sufficient?
Your Honor, I wouldn't want to speculate to that. I am not a physician. I don't know.
Would it satisfy the regulation in your view?
I'm not sure. Put that way, Your Honor, I don't think it would satisfy the regulation. I think that what would be that all reasonably foreseeable risks, a broad statement, you might go blind, is not going to cover it, because there are so many different things that could have gone wrong in so many different scenarios. I think that once the VA made this finding, that endophthalmitis, for example, and the retinal tear as well, were reasonably foreseeable, which is the finding they've made. Once they've made that finding, that risk specifically needs to be disclosed to the client. The purpose for informed consent is twofold. Primarily, these regulations, per the regulatory history, indicate that these were prescribed to protect the veteran. And as was pointed out in some of the cases cited in this court's supplemental order, the purpose for this informed consent is because the patient needs to have the information that these doctors have to an extent that is reasonable. The other reason for informed consent is conceivably to protect physicians so that they have an affirmative defense against a charge of negligence. But there's nothing here that provides that defense, because there's nothing on this consent form that says that the doctor did inform Mr. Holcomb of these risks. And as was stated in briefing, it is the Secretary's burden to show that this risk was disclosed. The Secretary has not met that burden. The Secretary instead comes here and says, take our word for it. He says, this consent form says that risks were disclosed to him as described above, yet above that as described above is nothing that happened to this veteran. It's just asking us to take the VA's word that these things were described and were disclosed.
This is the DHA handbook indicating
the generic consent decision. The VHA handbook indicates only some prescriptions for what these VA hospitals may and may not do. As I cited back in my supplemental brief, I'm sorry, Mr. Hoffman cited in his supplemental brief, there is also a provision that says that these conditions must be disclosed. I don't believe that the VHA handbook needs to be given that much weight in this case. All it does is lays out some of the things that broadly pertain to some documentation. It does not excuse plain language of the regulation that it has to be a fully informed consent. It only says this is one way to document something. I would say that in this case, again, the question is not documentation. The question is fully informed consent. But reading the VHA handbook, as far as just that section, the other sections, as I pointed out, do indicate plainly that a fully informed consent is required. But it doesn't define that paragraph cited by paragraph 5, I believe it was, cited by the Secretary. Does not say appropriate documentation, according to the Secretary, means this. It doesn't say that. He's coming in now. The Secretary comes in now, asking for deference to this broad sheet that really doesn't help illuminate the regulation at all, and doesn't even say appropriate documentation in 17.32 is defined as. I don't believe that it is entitled to any deference. I believe if there were... I would submit that the regulation is clear on fully informed consent, which is what the question is before this court. And to the extent that there would be any ambiguity in the statute of regulation, I would submit that under the Gardner decision, it would be construed in favor of the veteran, Mr. Halcombe.
What support do you have for saying that, what is it,
Endophthalmitis
had to be written in the record as opposed to just orally advised to the patient?
I would say that the regulation 17.32, first of all, would say that. And the reason that I'm answering your question a little bit backwards. The regulation 17.32 is what does. The reason that we even have to get to the regulation 17.32 is because the board made a finding here that this was a reasonably foreseeable risk. And it based that on the medical opinion that said, though rare, this could result. Once they said that it was reasonably foreseeable, that threw it out of the 1151 language that says if it was not reasonably foreseeable, we could have negligence here. So now we have to look, because it's foreseeable, presumably. If it was foreseeable, why wouldn't the doctor disclose it to the veteran? Why would the veteran make a claim? If he knew that this was going to happen, why would he think, hey, something's wrong with my eye, this shouldn't have happened? Why make the claim? It's something of a public policy reason for 17.32 and something of kind of a commonsensical approach to it. If Mr. Halcombe expected endophthalmitis, he would have probably said, well, my doctor told me this infection, this retinal tear, this vision loss, fair game, he told me. I remember when he told me. I'm not gonna go after this doctor. Then he made a claim, presumably because he knew something was wrong, because something happened that to him was not foreseeable. And that is who this statute protects, the patient. And if it wasn't foreseeable to the patient, it is because the doctor did not disclose it. And that's if you want to get that far. The true question here is, can the Secretary come in now and show that the doctor did give him information regarding these conditions? And the Secretary has not done so. He just provides a broad VHA handbook broadly speaks in sweeping terms of appropriate documentation, yet does not say this is what appropriate documentation is according to the regulation. And it doesn't have anything to do with the other part of 17.32, which requires a fully informed consent to be given.
The medical opinions indicated that this was a rare, this would be a rare occurrence as a result of that procedure.
Yes, Your Honor.
The VHA handbook indicates that risks that are extremely unlikely do not have to be described.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I believe that it says that the risks that are unlikely need to be described.
Risks that are extremely unlikely do not have to be described.
What is Your Honor reading?
VHA handbook 1004.1, 7A, subparagraph 5.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear where you were pointing me in the
1004,
mm-hmm.
7 under the informed consent process.
In the 2001 edition?
Actually, it's dated January 2003.
Oh. Bear with me, Your Honor. I apologize. Paragraph 7, subpart
A, 5.
Yes, Your Honor. I cited that in the supplemental briefing as well. This is the 2003 edition. The 2001 edition, which presumably would apply to this situation, as the procedure took place in 2002, and the Secretary indicated that that is what he is asking for deference to, it says, risks that are extremely unlikely do not have to be described unless the patient requests that information or unless such risks may result in death or permanent disability.
Mm-hmm.
What we have here is a permanent disability. The risk must have been should have been disclosed to him. But Mr. Halcombe cannot see as a result of several things that happened after this procedure, as was described in the board's decision. The renal tear, the endophthalmitis, it is what led to this permanent vision loss. It's a permanent disability. I would submit that under the Secretary's own VHA handbook, it is what needed to be disclosed because it could result in a permanent disability. And not only could it have resulted in a permanent disability, it did result in a permanent disability.
Do we know that for certain counsel, is there evidence in the record that indicates what the possible cause of the disability was?
The evidence in the record, VA only asked questions concerning Mr. Halcombe's claim, and the board did make an implicit finding of fact, I would submit, that stated that these were, in fact, the disabilities that resulted.
Can you direct me to the record?
Yes, Your Honor. The easiest place, Your Honor, without going directly to the medical evidence, although I'd be happy to go there too, would be the board's findings of fact. The April 2000, and finding of fact one specifically. The April 2002, in April 2002, the veteran underwent same day surgery at the VAMC, and I believe this is a mistake, Marion, Indiana. It was actually in Illinois. But for removal of the cataract in his left eye and implantation of replacement lens, the veteran developed endophthalmitis following the surgery.
And you're suggesting that is finding by the board that the surgery was the possible cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's that record on appeal page 2, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that if you would, and if you would like, I can go through, I think that I have them tagged here, or on rebuttal I can show you where in the medical record that would be as well. Because what VA asked, and how VA has always treated this claim, the regional office on up, were questions about this guy has vision loss. He has retinal tears and endophthalmitis and vision loss that resulted from the VA medical care. Was it a result of negligence or an event not reasonably foreseeable? It's been treated that way all the way up.
Let me direct your attention to the record on appeal, page 8. The last paragraph, in fact, the last sentence in that paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll quote it. Medical evidence does not otherwise indicate whether the identified retinal tears and retinal detachment are related to the veteran's left cataract surgery performed at the Marion Medical Center in April, or due to any surgical procedure performed on the veteran's left eye at St. Louis University. And how would you interpret the board's statement there?
I would still say that the board is dealing with this under the presumption that this permanent disability did result from the VA procedure, but to the extent that there's any question about the retinal tear, I don't think that there's anything in the record that I can think of right offhand that would clear that up. But regardless, the endophthalmitis and the vision loss are still on appeal, and certainly the endophthalmitis was treated as a result of this surgery, and certainly the endophthalmitis was a serious disability that should have been disclosed to the patient. So whether or not the retinal tear is or is not, although I would submit that if this is unclear, any claim should be construed in favor of the veteran. But in case this court chooses not to look at the retinal tear, because it may or may not have happened, even though the VA proceeded, it seems to me, it proceeded under the supposition that it did happen because of this. But even if not, the endophthalmitis did. So
we have several medical procedures that took place, one in Marion, Illinois, the other at Poplar Bluff, and the other is at St. Louis University. And what I see in the board's decision is an indication that the board's not certain what the proximate cause is. Certainly with respect to the retinal tear, but possibly with respect to encephalitis as well.
I respectfully disagree with Your Honor's reading of the board decision.
Okay, you can mention more disagreement in your rebuttal. Your time's up.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McNabb?
Please, the court. Before the court today is a case in which the board's relevant factual finding is supported by the only evidence of record. The sole evidence of record establishes that appellant was provided the necessary information and his formal consent to the procedure was obtained. The secretary asked the court to affirm that board factual finding. This is a case in which appellant, in the 4 years of development of the claim after the procedure, made no assertion that contradicted his signed consent form, which indicated that the relevant aspects of the procedure, its indications, risks, benefits, and alternatives had been discussed with him in understandable language, that he was given the opportunity to ask questions concerning the procedure, that he comprehended the discussion, and that he freely consented without duress or coercion.
Mr. McNabb, do you know what the requirements would be in the Illinois law concerning providing consent to a patient?
I do not know. In this case, it's our view that for benefits under 1151 and under 3.361, that the informed consent and the documentation of the informed consent must satisfy the requirements of 17.32D, and that the documentation in this case did so.
And 17.32D describes the process, is that correct?
17.32C describes the process, and 17.32D indicates that that process must be appropriately documented in a medical record.
And is it the Secretary's position that a restatement of that process in the record, in the medical records, is sufficient to satisfy the requirement that informed consent has been provided?
It's the Secretary's view that the term in 17.32D about appropriate documentation in the medical record is one that contains some ambiguity, and when it that ambiguity has been interpreted by the Secretary in the VHA handbook, and there are two sections of the VHA handbook that relate to 1732. There is a section that clearly contemplates a discussion between the practitioner and the patient, and that tracks the language of 1732C, and then there's a separate section about documentation that tracks the requirements of 1732D's requirements to appropriately document. In fact, the VHA handbook, appellant in his argument indicated that the handbook just provide some broad and general guidance. In fact, the handbook does use 1732D's language in its statement of requirements. At page 4 of the 2001 handbook, the documentation section opens with a statement that says the informed consent process must be appropriately documented in the medical record. This tracks exactly the language of 1732D.
Well, for purposes of the hospital's risk management and quality assurance program, how does one ascertain whether or not the doctor provided the correct information?
What the VA asks physicians to do, as of the 2001 handbook, is to follow the VHA handbook's procedures to adequately document, and those, in the Secretary's interpretation of appropriately document, included a list of 10 items that appear on page 5 of the handbook. The handbook indicates that the progress note must include all of the appropriate of the following specific items. It lists 10 things. Appellant's assertion here only relates to one of those.
Well, we just presume that the doctor is always giving the correct information?
I don't know that we ask you to make that presumption. What we ask you to do in this case is determine whether VA met the requirements of 1732D, because to receive benefits under 1151 and under 3.361, negligence only comes about due to a lack of informed consent if 1732D's requirements are not met.
And my point is that if in the medical record it just simply says the doctor advised the patient of the risk involved, period, that's sufficient.
That is sufficient to meet Section 6 of the 2001 version of the VHA handbook. However, in a given case, if an appellant makes a specific assertion that he wasn't told about a specific thing, that is a question that can be developed, like we assist veterans to develop claims all the time. We certainly could, had we any reason to think this was in question, have proceeded to develop the issue. However, the record is entirely silent over the 4-year period of any assertion by the veteran that he didn't receive the proper notice. And in fact, I would point out, apparently his reply brief, when the court pointed out in its briefing order that there was nothing in the record that indicated such an assertion, appellant in his reply brief incorrectly stated sort of for the first time that there was such a fact in the record. At page 5 of the appellant's reply brief, supplemental brief, appellant stated that a statement that he made in conjunction with the filing of his Form 9 indicates he would not have undergone the procedure had he known that endophthalmitis and presumably division loss could have resulted from the procedure. He cites the record 530. And record 530 is entirely silent for any such statement. And in fact, the veteran, after having the endophthalmitis and the resulting vision loss in 2002, then proceeded in 2003 to have the same surgery on the other eye with the same position. Some appellant's assertion in his supplemental briefs that record at 530 should be read in the way he states is simply without merit.
I'd like to get back to what Judge Green was asking. Are we in agreement that the appellant could have filed a suit under the Federal Tort Claims Act?
Certainly.
In the Southern District of the Federal Court in Illinois?
Presumably.
What law relative to informed consent would pertain at that
point? Presumably the law of Illinois. I'm not that familiar with the Federal Tort Claims Act, but it's my understanding, looking at this court's and the Federal Circuit's case law, that FTCA cases are handled in federal courts under state law, so presumably the state law would apply in that case. We would argue simply that this is not at all that kind of case. This is a specific VA benefit created by 1151 and 3.361, and that the requirements of 3.361 are what determine whether you're entitled to the 1151 benefit, and 3.361 requires that 1732 be substantially met. It allows for it not to be fully met, but 1732D is the portion of the relevant regulation that requires documentation. Insofar as we allege that it does contain ambiguous language, the Secretary has interpreted that language, and we believe that the court's case law is clear that that interpretation is entitled to deference.
Counsel, I'm just a country lawyer. I'm like to look at these things in practical terms. So let me ask you a couple of practical questions. Were the risk of the appellant contracting endophthalmitis and the retinal tear discussed with the appellant?
I would say two things about that question. One, the record does not make that clear.
We agree on that.
The record makes clear that the risks and benefits were discussed with him, but not specifically what those risks were. However, the requirement in the regulation is not that endophthalmitis be told to the veteran. Rather, the requirement is that it be that risks be explained in language that is understandable to the veteran. So it's certainly, appellant's brief seems to allege that if we didn't tell him, we didn't write down endophthalmitis on that form, we didn't tell him about the risks. We would argue that that wouldn't even meet the standard of the regulation, which requires a discussion in understandable language, not with
difficulty. Okay. Let me ask a follow-up question. In the handbook that you referenced on page 4, looking at the section number 6, labeled documentation of informed consent discussion, paragraph A2.
Sorry, section 4, paragraph A2?
On page 4, section 6, paragraph A2.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
That's the document that you're referring to, is that correct?
That is.
Okay. For treatments and procedures that require the patient's signature consent, documentation must include a progress note that details the informed consent discussion. What progress note would you turn to in the record that, quote, details the informed consent discussion?
It is the one that appears a couple times in the record, but most often cited at record 427. We believe that section 2, part B, I'm sorry, that begins on page 5, specifically spells out, it's titled Informed Consent Progress Note, and it lists 10 items that must appear in the progress note. And appellant's only assertion is relevant to number 6. We believe that it asks, number 6 asks for a statement that relevant aspects of the treatment or procedure, including indications, risks, or benefits, and alternative options have been discussed with the patient in language that the patient understood. We've got just such a statement, and I think it's clear that the record at 427 satisfies Section 6 of Part B about the requirements of an informed consent progress note under the handbook.
Who has the regulatory responsibility to sign that progress note, in addition to the patient?
The requirements, I believe it's the three parties. If memory serves, the treating physician and our witness, which we have in this case. But again, appellant's assertion, they're not about any of the other portions. He's made one specific allegation of insufficiency of the notice here, and that is about risks.
I understand. Who signed this progress note?
The progress note. The progress note appears to be signed by Dr. Emlin, who was the
Dr.
Emlin, who did this procedure and the procedure the next year on the other hour, and also appeared by a registered nurse.
And that progress note indicates, basically, I assume that your position is that meeting Section 6 of the handbook, this progress note, by stating the relevant aspects of the above treatment, the indications of risk, benefits, alternatives have been discussed with the patient, in understandable language, and the patient has had opportunity to ask questions, in your view, that details the informed consent discussion?
I believe that it meets the requirements of what should be in the informed consent discussion, because Section B of this handbook section details the 10 items that must be included. And so it details a level of specificity that's required to meet the relevant portion of A2 that you cited earlier.
We still don't know if endophthalmitis and retinal tear were discussed with the patient.
We don't. Of course, we don't know that retinal tear was a result of this procedure.
Does the secretary concede that cataract surgery was the proximate cause of the disability?
I agree with you that the board decision appears to at least, and Dr. Mattis fell within days, and the physician's opinion of record that discussed the question of negligence did address endophthalmitis at record 436. So it appeared at least to look at that resultant disability and determine whether it was related to the procedure.
Well, I think that
I believe the evidence seems to indicate that endophthalmitis followed from the surgery in question.
That would be yes.
As I
seems
of the endophthalmitis, yes, and not of the other resultant conditions.
Mr. McNabb, I keep going to the record at 427, and
yes,
I look at the typewritten entry, and I ask, is that entry something that is almost so generic that it could apply to any operative procedure?
That statement, it certainly could, but what we have is that after a discussion took place, it's clear that 1732 B and C contemplate sort of a two-step process. One is that a discussion take place between the provider and the patient, and then two, that the process of that discussion be documented.
Right. So it's documented that perhaps something occurred. You also indicated, though, that there's a requirement that there be a detailed discussion of what entailed between the doctor and the patient.
Well, we believe that that the regulation requires that it be appropriate, that the process be appropriately documented, not that there be a
just the process, not what it is that you said.
That is the language of the regulation. 17.32 D says the informed consent process must be appropriately documented in the medical record. And we believe that the handbook, by picking up that exact language in its opening of the informed consent process documentation section, clearly intended what follows those requirements to be the Secretary's interpretation of meeting 1732D's requirements.
Doesn't the statute counselor also say, we're talking about 38 U.S.C. 7331, to the maximum extent practicable, all patient care furnished under this title shall be carried out only with the full and informed consent of the patient. Full and informed consent of the patient. The handbook that you read from that Chief Judge Green referred to says the documentation must include a progress note that detailed the informed consent discussion. And I see no progress note that details a discussion other than what you referred to on 427, unless there's another document that I'm not familiar with.
There isn't. I mean, there are two informed consent documents here because the requirements are for a progress note and also for the document at 426. But in terms of the requirements of the progress note, we think that that the section B, which lists the 10 items that must appear, is the Secretary's interpretation of how a physician, an instruction to a physician, of how to appropriately document it. And in fact, the VHA handbook provided a sample at Appendix B1 that included just such generic language.
Let me ask you another basic question. I'm coming to it. If the progress note indicated only that the doctor met with the patient and discussed everything, would that meet the requirements under the regulation?
I think that's very general.
Right.
But what the regulation requires is that the process be appropriately documented, and not that a stenographer be present in the room. And
well, that's my very general example. I have another one. That's a 50-page recitation of the specifics of what was discussed. Now, between those two extremes, all I want to know is, did the guy know we had some risks to deal with?
And I believe that the only evidence of record indicates that he did know.
About encephalitis and retinal tear.
I don't know that the retinal tear, that the evidence establishes the retinal tear was a result of this. And I don't believe that a statement that we told him about endophthalmitis would actually satisfy the requirements
that it be explained, that the risks be explained in understandable language.
The sentence that said we discussed everything, all risks, would or would not meet the regulations from your standpoint?
If the sentence said we discussed all risks and the veteran over 4 years made no allegation that he hadn't been, that all risks had not been explained to him, then I think the board would have one piece of evidence to consider that it should come to a conclusion that all necessary evidence information was given to the veteran and that there would be a plausible basis for
you
such a finding.
You agree the 50-page transcript that says everything was discussed and included the discussion would meet the regulations?
So long as it had these 10 items or, you know, it, and took place in this relevant time period.
Well, for this your position, I believe, is that the regulation is complied with. The form says that I've explained everything to the patient. He understands the consequences of potential complications. And we have absolutely nothing in the record from the appellant indicating that that is not true.
I think that's correct. There's absolutely nothing in the record.
So we have a presumption. But we don't have anything to rebut the presumption, and nothing more is required in your view.
I think that's correct. The one piece of evidence that relates to this question includes three witnesses indicating that risks and benefits were explained to the veteran, including a signature by the veteran and the physician. That's the only relevant evidence in the entire record. The board made a factual finding that based on that one piece of evidence in it, I certainly think that there's a plausible basis for the board's factual finding in that respect.
And we would have a different case if the assert that no, none of this was ever explained. We might have affidavits in the file from the physician or the missing nurse remembering or recalling what had been related to the office.
Absolutely. Were there an assertion made on the opportunity for the agency to assist in developing the veteran's claim? As to the raised issue would be there. But the appellant never raised the issue, and there was no reason for the board to think that the one piece of evidence that indicated that the risks were explained was not adequate to support a finding that the risks were explained.
It seemed to me that a great deal of time could be consumed in writing down every potential complication, every potential medical procedure. That's an observation.
Well, I agree, and I think that the regulation actually contemplates sort of a two-step process. C contemplates a discussion that is tailored to the specific veteran's condition and that the language be used that he understands, that he expressed that he understands, but then 1732D requires that the process laid out in 1732C be documented in exactly the way that this was documented in this case.
Counsel, does the regulation require that the veteran has a duty to indicate that he was not provided informed consent, or the regulation require that the VA has a duty to provide informed
VA does have a duty to provide informed consent.
The duty is with the Secretary.
To provide the informed consent, yes, and to document it. And we believe that the documentation here meets the regulatory requirement.
And that's really what we're talking about, is whether or not this documentation and the phrase that we discussed on the record at 427 meets the regulatory requirement of providing the informed consent.
That's correct. And we believe that because, not providing informed consent, but in appropriately documenting the informed consent process. And that, we believe, is an ambiguous term, appropriately documented, and that the Secretary has provided a definition, an interpretation of that ambiguous term in the form of the handbook, which instructs its physicians on how to do just that.
You're familiar with some of the cases that you cited in your brief, and some of the cases applicable under the Federal Tort Claims Act regarding informed consent, right, and differences in jurisdictions and what is required?
Well, I'm familiar with the case, the Federal Circuit case, which explained that there are substantial differences between the two, and that a claim for under the Federal Tort Claim Act, and particular notice to VA of a claim under the Federal Tort Claim Act is not a claim under 1151.
Okay. Do those cases require something more than a generic statement from your perspective?
I'm not.
The risks or a specific risk discussion?
I'm not familiar with Federal Tort Claim Act rulings in that regard. It's our view that they would be irrelevant here where the question is entitlement to a benefit under 1151, under 3.361, and under the 1732, in particular, Section D of that regulation. VA therefore requests that the court affirm the board's decision in this case because the board's factual finding regarding informed consent is supported by a plausible basis in the record. And with respect to the question of appropriately documenting the informed consent process, the Secretary urges the court to hold that the relevant regulation contains an ambiguous term, that VA has interpreted that ambiguous term, that its interpretation of VA is entitled to substantial deference, that the interpretation requires only that the categories discussed in the informed consent process be documented, and that the documentation in this case meets that standard.
Thank you very much.
No further questions?
Thank you. Stoltz, you have 10 minutes.
In this case, Your Honor, I believe that what needed to be in this progress note was that because VA has made the finding of fact, the board has made the finding of fact, that endophthalmitis was a reasonably foreseeable risk, I believe that risk needed to be disclosed to the client. And the Secretary gets up here, or the Secretary, argued when he was before Your Honor, that endophthalmitis still may not satisfy it because it has to be in terms reasonable to the veteran. There are many ways to explain how endophthalmitis is understandable. It is a very severe infection. It can cause blindness. Not to get into it, it's a factual thing. It's something that the doctor would have to do. But because it's a big word, shouldn't scare off the fact that endophthalmitis needed to be disclosed.
Your position is that the regulatory requirements were not met with this documentation of informed consent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And between the two extremes that I posited, the one-liner that said everything was discussed in the 50-page transcript, what should this progress note contain with the regulatory requirements?
Excuse me, Your Honor. A 50-page document of anything that can go wrong with an eye, I don't think is going to be necessary here.
But it would meet the requirements.
It would meet the requirements.
Right.
Endophthalmitis was included on that 50 pages? Yes, it would, Your Honor. It would meet the requirements. But all the regulation calls for, and in my understanding of the statute, the reason the regulation calls for it is because under 1151, this court or the board would have to determine if this was a reasonably foreseeable event. If it was not reasonably foreseeable, Mr. Halcombe would have walked away with some benefit, I don't know what it would, what the rating would be, obviously. But if it was not reasonably foreseeable, he would have met the statute. So we have to go next to, was it reasonably foreseeable? And that's what triggers all of this informed consent. And so if endophthalmitis was on that 50 pages, it would have met the requirements. But in this case, no matter how you dress it up, Your Honor, the Secretary is asking us to prove a negative. He asked the appellant, who bears no burden in this case, to come up here and state he was not given the informed consent. When the regulations specifically provide that it is the Secretary, VA personnel, it is their duty to provide informed consent.
So in your view, what documentation would convince you that informed consent was provided on this progress note?
If it said on there, with the signature of the physician, we discussed that there was a risk of endophthalmitis, and the patient still agreed to undergo this procedure. That would probably be sufficient. That would at least put, to backtrack a little bit, it would at least be enough that the Secretary would have a case to say, no, we informed him. Absent then of something that Mr. Halcombe would come and say, no, 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 he says it, but I say I wasn't. At that point, maybe then it gets into the realm of we need to go out and get affidavits. It gets into more of a litigation type of phase. At that point, the physician has an affirmative defense. I would say that. Whether it is sufficient or not is not really the question. The doctor would have, and VA and the secretary would have, an affirmative defense to the charge of negligence at that point. But that's not what we have here.
Counselor, in the dialogue between you and Judge Davis, you're suggesting that the consent must refer specifically to an compromise. How's about the consent, just the net result? I understand that there are several complications that might ensue from my surgery, one of which may be blindness, sincere viewers. Is that not?
I would say no, Your Honor. I would.
Do you evaluate every potential complication in your view?
I would say that a serious infection that could result in blindness, I would say something like that would need to be explained to the veteran.
How many of those are there?
I did. This is not in the record. I did some research on endophthalmitis. It was quick research. I know that it wasn't going to be part of this record. It seemed that in my research, to take that for what it's worth, there were 10 to 20 different common causes or things that could happen with this type of procedure. Endophthalmitis was on it. It indicated on my little internet research, it indicated that it was in fact a rare occurrence, which I think has been conceded by the secretary. But nevertheless, it was on what I read. It was an occurrence that could have happened.
But to the average GI, isn't that a contradiction in terms of informed consent and then listing 10 or 20 conditions, all of which carry medical terminology, of course, versus the one that you find to be unacceptable, which is I understand that as a result of complications, I may be blinded as a result of this medical procedure, specifically.
But blinded isn't necessarily all that goes along with this type of condition. Endophthalmitis is an extraordinarily painful condition. I don't know, maybe, you know, certainly blindness.
Well,
your question
is just, you know, but having the name precisely the medical condition seems anomalous to me when the veteran is more concerned about the end result, which is either pain, suffering, blindness.
I think, that, again, the end result is more than blindness. It resulted in excruciating pain. And again, it needed to be, getting back just to what the regulation calls for. The regulation calls for it to be fully explained to him in language that he or she can understand. If the secretary could come up here and point to something, or any time along the way that this veteran has been claiming that negligence occurred on the part of VA, if the secretary could have come up and said, no, this is where we did it. We told him that the blindness, that endophthalmitis, that a severe pain, that a severe infection could result, then, again, he would have provided an affirmative defense. And we would be in a completely different boat. We would probably have to go out, and if Mr. Halcombe wanted to pursue his claim, we'd have to go get affidavits, obviously not in front of this court, but as proceeding below, and we'd have to figure that out. But that's not the case here. That's not the case. The secretary only asks us to prove the negative when the burden is on him. And whether or not that would be sufficient, again, I don't want to, as much as I don't have to, I don't want to speculate on that. And informed consent, according to other various sources, is something, you know, there are textbooks written on informed consent. And the AMA struggles with it. And jurisdictions struggle with it. And I know hospitals struggle with it because I know that this is a common cause of action. So as to what is sufficient, is really not for me to sit here and opine. The only thing I do know is that according to the Secretary's regulations, this broad consent form is not sufficient because it does not allow the veteran an opportunity to give his fully informed consent. And to the extent that the Secretary suggests that this was not always on appeal, or that this is the first time he's been told that the veteran doesn't think there is fully informed consent, I would invite the court's attention to record at 579, is putting before the board. I would also invite the court's attention to the fact that the board did address this issue. as it had a duty to do, because this veteran claimed negligence on the part of VA under 1151.
Counsel, the Secretary's position is that the generic statement here is sufficient under the regulations, and isn't what you're asking for going to wreak undue havoc on the Department of Veterans Affairs by requiring physicians, a thousand cases they deal with, to specify the potential risk that might exist in order to meet 1732?
The Secretary prescribed this regulation. It's the Secretary's regulation. We are asking the Secretary to comply with it. And again, I don't feel that it needs to be a 50-page document in a case like this. I don't know. There are many complicated procedures out there, and I haven't seen every case, because there's 800,000 veterans claims. But presumably, in other jurisdictions, this would have been listed, or the standard of care would have dictated that it be listed. The Secretary states only that reasonably foreseeable risks have to be stated. And in this case, the Secretary made a finding that the disability that this veteran has was reasonably foreseeable. At that point, the Secretary, and I'm sorry, the VA medical personnel, had a duty to disclose that risk. The Secretary now says, we did absent the veteran's showing. That's not what the regulation requires, and that's not what this court's case law has held on the burden of proof. The burden is on the Secretary. And I don't believe, to come back to your question, Your Honor, I don't believe that it can wreak havoc on VA's hospital system or medical system if the Secretary himself prescribed these regulations. It would only go to the point that these veterans, which is the whole reason for these regulations, that the veterans have the information available to make a fully informed decision. I don't think that could possibly wreak havoc on a veterans hospital administration. It could only help these veterans make better choices for their health care.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. The court will greet counsel at the bar and will stand adjourned.